Chromosomes. Little strands of nucleic acids and proteins are the fundamental genetic instructions that tell us who we are at birth. Most people are born with 46 chromosomes, but each year in the United States, about 6,000 people are born with an extra chromosome, making them a person with Down syndrome. If you've ever encountered someone with Down syndrome, you know that they are some of the kindest, most joyful people you will ever meet. They truly have something extra. My name is Lisa Nichols, and for 30 years, I have been both the CEO of Technology Partners and the mother to Allie. Allie has something extra in every sense of the word. I have been blessed to be by her side as she impacts everyone she meets. Through these two important roles as CEO and mother to Allie, I have witnessed countless life lessons that have fundamentally changed the way I look at the world. While you may not have an extra chromosome, every leader has something extra that defines who you are. Join me as I explore the something extra in leaders from all walks of life and discover how that difference in each of them has made a difference in their companies, their families, their communities, and in themselves. If you like this episode today, please go to Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen and leave us a 5-star rating. Before we get started, I'm excited to share that my book, Something Extra, is now available. It is rooted in the remarkable spirit of our daughter, Allie, and the heartfelt conversations we've had on the podcast. You'll find wisdom and practical tools to ignite the leader within you and uncover your own Something Extra. Visit somethingextrabook.com or find it at Amazon or in all major bookstores to order your copy today. I am delighted to have Sam Cook on the show today. Sam is the Chief Financial Officer at Brinkman Constructors. Well, Sam Cook, I am so delighted to have you on the Something Extra podcast. Thank you so much. We were just talking about our schedules, and I know that your schedule is insane. So the fact that you're taking the time to do this really means a lot. So, and I cannot wait for our listeners to learn from you.
How could I not find time for this? Thank you so much, Liz. I'm super excited to be here.
Yes, I'm excited too. Well, I always kind of like to go back. So Sam and I, we know each other. I remember when you came to Brinkman. Mm-hmm. I remember Lynn Shaw, correct, which is your CHRO, said mm-hmm. the two of you need to know each other. And we had lunch, and the rest is history. And we're very grateful. Technology Partners is very grateful to be doing some work with Brinkman and with you, Sam. And so that's really how Sam and I got to meet, and now we've done several things together, like galas and all kinds of things. But let's go back. I want to take us back to you growing up. I knew that you grew up in a small town in Mexico. I don't think it had, you know, infrastructure or architecture. What was it like, and how did it shape your view of the possibility, Sam?
So Lynn Shaw, absolutely, she was a connection, so thank you for that, Lynn.
Yes.
So I was born and raised in Mexico. I was born actually in Mexico City, which is a huge, huge city, right? One of the biggest cities in the world. But very early, my parents moved to a border town where my dad was from. The name of this town is Piedras Negras, Coahuila, which if I translate it would be something like Blackstone City. But just to put context to everyone who's listening or viewing this, think about San Antonio, Texas, driving 2.5 hours south. And there's a town there that it's called Eagle Pass, Texas. And you cross that border, which is a 200-yard bridge, and you cross to my hometown, Piedras Negras, Coahuila. I was there. I was raised there since I was probably less than a year. So I would say that I am from that small town. It's a very small town. It still is. It's a border town, so imagine similar to Tijuana and other like bigger cities in that sense, but very small, not a lot of infrastructure where I was growing up, a very humble town. I always tell everyone that for me, it was never used normal to have like air conditioner or like, you know, hot water and in a, like on a regular basis, those things, particularly in my area, just was like not common. So it's those things that kind of like shape a little bit, like when I was able to go to other cities or visit family in other places, I would see how different everything was, or even the dichotomy to just cross the border and see that, oh my gosh, there's this whole world with infrastructure, huge hospitals, like even in this small town, Eagle Pass, Texas, right? They had malls and hospitals and McDonald's and things like that. And it was just like just crossing the border, right? Just you know, from my backyard, you could see it. So that itself obviously created a little bit of desire to learn other languages. My parents, my dad never spoke English. My mom doesn't really speak English other than basic to communicate now with her grandson. But, you know, it was that you got to learn other languages. My parents were very clear on English was a given that you had to, and so others. And so it was this kind of like being in a small town surrounded of possibilities, right? So I had family in other cities, bigger cities. So when I would go to these big cities, I was like, oh my gosh, it's so different from what I come from. And that created a lot of my personality. Like since I was a kid, I was a kid that I was reflecting on this because I do hear your podcast and I know we're going to talk about that. And, you know, I was that kid that, you know, always in all kinds of contests and you know, all kinds of stuff. And I was that kid who always, you know, getting the best grades and doing all those things. But looking back, I'm proud of that version of me, because that version of me who was so used to different things was just like always hoping to get to the next level, even as a kid. And so eventually I got a scholarship for one of the top universities in Monterrey, Mexico. And that was my chance to kind of like, you know, explore, go out. I left when I was 16. I got a scholarship at 16, yes. And then from there, the rest is history.
So you started college when you were 16, Sam?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. My goodness, wow.
Yeah, so I was on the younger side.
Yeah, wow. I mean, I knew that you were brilliant, but yeah, that just shows you that you definitely, you had ambition. I'm thinking it created this, you grew up as a curious child, you know.
Well, there was always books. I'm seeing your background, and I'll tell you one thing. Well, I had a lot of like, you know, limitations in my surrounding. Books was never something that I lacked. Like my parents, a lot of things, you know, there were things that we could need, but books were always available. And so therefore, I remember I was talking to my sister the other day about that, like, you know, how many books we always had, and architecture books and stuff like that. They were like completely out of what we were used to in our hometown. Mm-hmm. And yet, you know, I remember spending so many hours just looking at the pictures, reading, and yeah, books.
Yeah, that's good. I mean, what do they say? You are the person you are in 5 years. The only difference between now and then will be the books that you read and the people you meet. Mm-hmm. Right. You know, and I love books too. I grew up as an only child, so books were my friends, and I would devour them. So I love that you and I share that in common. Well, I know that you had an interest in architecture. Was it from the books? I mean, sparked that interest?
So my dad actually studied architecture, but moving from a huge city to a small town where there was no infrastructure, not real opportunities for that. My dad was doing more so construction work then. Mm-hmm. And it was more like every so often, because the town itself didn't have a lot to offer for that area. But that's why I had a lot of access to books like that. But in general, I mean, of any kind. But I knew when I was about 11, I was thinking about this. When I was about 11 years old, I decided I wanted to study architecture. And so much because in my, I was always in the public schools in Mexico. And when you're in junior high, I think it would be the equivalent for us, you have the opportunity to study a trade. For me, I picked drafting. I knew that I wanted to at some point be in architecture or construction. And so I went more so into drafting, so I could kind of like eventually do some kind of work like that. Mm-hmm. Eventually in high school, I got into the trade that I picked for high school, because it's very trade driven. It was more computer programming, but it was kind of like more so about technology and trying to understand that from that perspective.
Right.
I knew when I was like 10 or 11 that I wanted to get into construction and architecture. And I think, again, it was my, you know, because I knew where I was, there wasn't any of that. Mm-hmm. And I was like, well, how can I do that? How can I be part of being that? And so when I go to Monterrey, Mexico, I get a full scholarship, and I was so blessed. But again, it was years and years of since I my sister and I, like, this story is funny because my sister is 9 years older than me, and so, but we're very close. And the other day we were remembering, because I'm always very like, oh, okay, the next plan, and what are we going to do and how we're going to do it. And I'm always stressing her about something. Like, and she calls me, we were talking about, Sam, you were like 11 years old or 10, and you're calling me like, in 4 years, you're going to try to get a scholarship, and you were stressing about how can you figure out how to get to that scholarship. And she's like, I cannot understand how, when you were 11 or 12, where you were so stressed about scholarship and you know, I was that kid. And so eventually, mm-hmm. after so many years of trying to get that scholarship, I get it. And I go to Monterrey, Mexico, which is a huge city, very modern, a lot of infrastructure. I tell people, if you haven't had the opportunity to go to big cities in Mexico, Monterrey, Mexico City, Guadalajara, those are big cities to be. And it's kind of a mix between LA and New York with mountains. So,
okay.
So when I had the chance to move, you see a whole different world, right? You see, mm-hmm. The universities are huge. You see the campuses, you see the big buildings. And I started to work within 3 months of me moving. And I started working in construction, like as an assistant of an engineer or like a secretary or whatever I could do. At that point, like, I was doing it. And so
I read that you worked for an engineering firm and you were making $3.80 an hour.
Yes.
And you were going to school full time. I mean, wow. Sam, yeah. That just in and of itself, but you said you learned so many things in that job.
Yes.
So many things. Probably what was it? What's really popular? Tacos for breakfast?
Yeah. So for instance, that was a few things, right? Like the things that you're not going to learn in college and you're not going to learn in any MBA or anything. First, I'm still friends of many of the people that I work with during those times. And we keep ourselves. I'm not big in social media, but I use it because that's the only way where I can keep up with the people that I've been in.
Absolutely. Yes.
In the world. And so I do use social media for those reasons. But first, I remember, like, tacos. I tell everyone, when I realized that if I had to do something and I needed to ask for help, if I brought tacos in the morning, life was easier. For some reason, just like everyone was in a better mood. Everyone was more willing. And I was like, it's so worth it. So if I save this much and I go and buy tacos for everyone, like, literally, like, my life would be easier that day. But no, in all seriousness, it's also creating that level of, you know, connection with others. But that job, I wrote an article on LinkedIn about that. I didn't have a title. I mean, sometimes I would open the office, and that meant that it was a small office. If I was there earlier, that meant that I needed to check for the trash and I needed to make sure that things, like, I knew what I'm proud of me of that version is that nothing was below me. And I love that, because now, you know, you get to a point where you're like, well, is that the best use of my time? Is that this and that? But back then, everything was like, oh, yeah, of course, I'll do that. And so that attitude of me, thank goodness that I had that right, you know, mentality, mm-hmm. Helped me to not see anything as a small thing. And I learned from how to manage an office to how to figure out, you know, the real math. And you know, just create that. And I never had a title in that role.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I'm so grateful for that no one gave me a title, and therefore it was whatever is available, then I'll do it.
You know what? You were there to create value. I mean, somebody has to empty the trash cans, right? Nobody's going to want to be there if the trash cans are overflowing. I mean, really, you were there to create value. And I love, you know, so don't, if you are a listener and you've got a job that you don't feel like is, you know, as important or whatnot, no, it is. Every job is important. And just the attitude that you approach that job, people take notice of that too, right? I mean,
well, it did.
It's having a good attitude.
And it did. And I mean, you know, now, of course, we have interns, and I look at all the, you know, it's how different my world was from that. And, I learned so much, and actually doing things like that. Like, I don't even drink coffee. And I remember, like, having to put coffee for people. I was like, I don't even drink coffee, so how do I do this? But even those skills that there weren't in for me, it was just creating my ability to, you know, when I brought coffee to someone, said, so what are you working on? What are you doing? And so why are you doing what you're doing? Right. And I was that person who I was very curious, and, you know, trying to figure out like what I wanted to do. But I worked with an engineering firm. I also worked with an architecture firm. And I remember the first day I joined to that small architecture firm, they were using AutoCAD. And I, back then at college, we were starting to use Revit, and I was like great at SketchUp. It was a software super easy to use. And I was like, I think we need to start using other softwares, right? And I look at back to even at that age, I was like, should we do something different? Should we think about, but I think it was the right attitude I had, that people were willing to listen.
Absolutely.
Like, okay, we can listen for a second.
Right. I love that. It's a great lesson for us, right? You know, to not discount what others say, but to take the time to listen. Because, yeah, I mean, I'm sure you had some really great ideas. Well, let's talk about this, because you transitioned from architecture to finance.
Yeah.
Now you build financial frameworks, not necessarily buildings, although you're working in a construction company. How did that transition happen? And, you know, I would love, and then I'd also love for you to answer this question, Sam. You've said that really building buildings and the architectural background has really helped you when you've built financial systems. And I'd love to understand that parallel.
Yeah. So it's a fun story. So when I was in Mexico, I got my degree in architecture and a master's in construction. So I knew that construction was definitely the area where I wanted to grow my career, at least for the first 10 years. Right. Mm-hmm. I always joke that I still thought that I was going to be designing huge buildings, but then I was like, well, maybe I'm better at some other things. Maybe design is what I want to do for myself, but not for everyone else. And so, in this journey of trying to find, you know, the next opportunity, I get this opportunity to work for a huge company. The name is FEMSA. And what they do, they have different divisions. And one of it, imagine it's like 7-Eleven, and they would build Oxus, which is the equivalent to 7-Eleven, put it in that context. And we were building Oxus and all over Mexico. And it was like thousands of them. And also in South America, which I was lucky to be part of the group that started to design for Colombia. And so I had a chance to also work with that group. So anyways, we were doing that, and I was put in the area of construction investments. And I learned from a very small spot, I learned how performance worked. And I learned how huge companies would make decisions on where to allocate these strategic places based on other data points. And back then, I mean, you're talking about when there was no Power BI, there was no data analytics per se, but it was like understanding data at a big point and trying to figure out what was going to make one of these stores successful. From a design perspective, we were going to make decisions based on those data points that had nothing to do with architecture or construction, but it had everything to do with the location and the products that likely are to be sold there, right? So think about all the things I just said that had nothing to do with construction itself. But ultimately, construction was designed based on those potential outcomes for the store to be the most successful. So I was put in this position with no technology back in those days, but trying to analyze all that and provide a recommendation based on formulas and methodologies that this huge company had established. And I am very, very blessed with life that put me in that position to be in a company that had a construction division, but their mindset was engineering and logistics. And so doing so helped me to understand all of the things that I could do that had nothing to do with what I learned in architecture school, but I could apply it as process driven to what I was planning to do eventually, right? Mm-hmm. So I do that for about a year and a half. And then I get this opportunity to move to another job that was a huge residential tower that we were going to build in San Pedro. And so that was more so construction, but they needed someone to drive the cost management of this building. And this was a $300 million project. Think about more than 15 years ago. So $300 million project, than 15 years ago, it was a big investment in one of the biggest, one of the most high-end residential areas in Monterrey, Mexico. And I get this opportunity to work with this company. And I was very young. I was probably like 21 years old. And this guy took a chance on me. After talking to me and says, okay, you got the position, so you have to build a team. And I had to build a team of 6-8 people who were by far older than me, a lot more experienced. Mm-hmm. And we go in working with architects that wears Pelli architecture. So if anyone knows, have built like huge and very iconic towers. So working with people from India, United States, construction companies, like all over the world. And I happen to speak English, not as good as now, but back then I was like, yes, I can do it. Mm-hmm. And so I get that chance and I get to build this team. And we do a lot of value engineering. So we represent the owner, And the crazy thing is I worked a lot with the finance team to make sure that the pro forma applied and that we were going to be successful. So then I learned here, my gosh, this is what I'm good at, like figuring out how to do the business of construction successful itself. Maybe not so much at the design level, but in the field,
right?
But I can do this, right?
Mm-hmm.
At that time, of course, I had already done work enough in the field, and I would still go to the field, and I would still do all this work that ultimately had to happen in order for me to be able to do value engineering, meet with the subcontractors, going through all the drawings, understanding the cities, all the things that need to happen. But I learned that I didn't needed to know the details. I needed to know how to manage the overall like vision of what we were trying to accomplish. And by the end of that job, I was like, I'm good at this. I'm actually good at something that is in the construction field. And from there, I had people reaching out all over about, so you know how to do this cost engineering thing. So, but at that point, I don't have any true credentials that will allow me to move to the financial group.
Mm-hmm.
Eventually, I decide to apply for a job in the United States. I put my resume on LinkedIn.
What year was that, Sam?
Man, so I was probably like 23 years old, if that
okay.
makes sense.
Oh, wow.
So
like, okay.
That's more than 15 years ago. So,
right.
So LinkedIn wasn't a big deal back then. LinkedIn was, you know, people understood LinkedIn.
Nobody used it, though.
Nobody used it.
Right.
I got obsessed about trying to understand how to use this tool. I was like, I need to figure out because this is the only way I have to connect to the world outside Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
Back then you could do like a lot of like websites and log your resume and stuff like that. But actually the one who like encouraged me pretty hard was my sister, who is an engineer. She works in San Antonio, Texas. And she was like, you have to apply, you have to do all this. And so I put my resume and I started getting calls. Eventually I make a decision to come to the States. I start working with Armanino, now it's called Armanino, back then it was Brunsmith Willis. And I stayed there not long because Clayco stole me. I work at Clayco Construction right after that. But when I moved to Clayco, I started to do a lot of cost engineering. I was like the first person to do cost engineering for this huge construction company in St. Louis. And they gave me the freedom to go about it. To what you needed to do and how you needed to do it. And so eventually I get more so into trying to cross-reference everything that you can do in the construction side and say, how can we do that to the finance? How can we forecast better? How can we do better profit plans? How can we do all that? And then during that time, I went back to school. I got an MBA from Webster University, and then I decided I was going to do a master's in finance as well while working. And that's how I was able to kind of like
to really transition. Learn. You had the credentials. Yes.
You have the credentials, but actually use them. And I tell if there's any young person listening, I love studying, as you can tell, like I'm someone who loves school, but it's better when you're intentional about it, when you know, why you want to do it.
Right.
And I knew what I wanted to do with it. And so therefore, when I went to school, I loved it. I was like, mm-hmm. I love it.
Even you were all in.
Yeah.
You were all in. I love that. That's good. You had an end goal in mind. It wasn't just to go to school for school's sake. I love that. Well, let me ask you this. So like coming to, you know, coming to the States, I mean, was that hard? Sam, was that a big cultural change for you?
It is. And I tell some people when we talk about this, because sometimes I have the opportunity to talk to high schools in my hometown and stuff like that. And I keep this to myself, but sometimes I tell myself, I'm so glad that I didn't know how difficult it was going to be. And I'm so glad that I had nothing to lose. When you have nothing to lose, when your pockets are empty, there's mm-hmm. nothing that you're going to lose. Like, I remember my mom, I told this to my mom not long ago, because my mom is very, very simple, very humble, very smart, but you know, her world is a lot different than mine mm-hmm. in the sense of how our days go. And I remember when I was leaving a great job that I had in Monterey, a huge network of people that I had already worked with. I was successful. I had friends from college. I had, you know, all this, and I was going to move to St. Louis, Missouri. And I called my mom and I said, what if this doesn't work? And again, my mom with no resources, my sister and I are the ones who back then we took care of her. And she said, well, Sam, worst thing is you come back and come home. Right? Like the worst uh-huh. thing that can, and I am so grateful that those were the words. She knew my personality, that I was going to figure it out everything. But I knew that, well, okay, worst thing is I don't like it and I come back.
When you come back.
But it was difficult because what people doesn't know when you come to the States, you come with no credit whatsoever. The world doesn't, you don't exist for the world.
Right.
Apply for a driver's license. It's like you don't get the best rate, even though you've been driving. Like none of that exists.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have credit. You don't have anyone who back you up. I couldn't even be able to sign for a lease. So I end up like paying cash and this and that. It was like, and I was like 23 years old. So I was trying to figure out how to do all that. And thankfully I was, you know, people were, St. Louis was very graceful, and I found some people who were able to help. But you don't know those things when you're immigrating. You just think that, you know, you're there to work and you're going to figure it out. But the logistics are pretty complicated.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you have to have some resilience and grit and confidence in yourself. I mean, mm-hmm. yeah, but I look at things like that when we go through things like that. Now, when you're maybe stepping into something that's uncomfortable, you're like, well, I did that, so I can do this, right?
Like immigration, I tell people, this is an interesting approach. When I moved to the States, like I always tell people in Spanish, guys, I'm great at speaking in Spanish. I have valedictorian, great at giving speeches. But then in English, it was like, the technical words, right? I went to school in Spanish. Some of the things I can't, like, especially when I moved, like I was so paralyzed by the language because I was like, but I'm very smart. I almost like I was trying to tell people, but I promise you, I'm very smart. It's just not coming out like how I want it. But the other day, this is like full circle. I have a four and a half year old, and I was in he goes to an international Spanish school here in St. Louis. It's bilingual. It's actually an immersion school, so it's all in Spanish. And we were in our house, and he was eating. And I don't know what I said, but I said something like, Landon, what does it mean when someone has an accent? You know what he said? He said that person is very smart. So for me, it was full circle because all the concerns I had moving in about my ability to speak and the accent, all that, my son has a completely different wire in his head, right?
Mm-hmm.
For him, listening to someone with an accent means that that person is very smart.
Very
mom
smart.
Mom has an accent, and she knows that that means that
you're very smart.
Right? So it was a full, like, okay, maybe I'm doing something well. But hopefully
that doesn't change for you. There comes a point where they're like, they don't think they know anything, right? But I'm sure that won't happen.
No, but as an immigrant, truthfully, it's one of those things. As a professional immigrant, you want to make sure that, you know, you're doing a fair job to the fact that you come from another country and that you represent that country to some extent. And coming to St. Louis was a great decision, but it came with a lot of logistics that at that age, I had no clue. I was going to have to figure it out.
Right. Oh, my goodness. Well, I've got so many more questions for you, but we do need to take a quick break, and we'll be right back on the Something Extra podcast with Sam Cook.
Hey there. In a challenging business climate like this, savvy leaders look to technology to find an edge. This can mean the difference between staying ahead of the curve or playing catch up. It's time to collaborate with the highly skilled experts at Technology Partners. Our team of technologists draws upon decades of experience for your project, with each bringing a passion for solving problems and a track record of success. How can we help you overcome your biggest technology challenges? Visit technologypartners.net to book a free consultation with one of our leaders.
Welcome back, everyone, to the Something Extra podcast with my friend Sam Cook. So, Sam, let's talk just a little bit more about Clayco, and then I want to get into what you're doing today. You spent 8 years there.
Yeah, it was actually, yeah, I think that it's a little bit off, but it was about 9 or 10 years, almost 10, but yes.
What did you love the most about that chapter of your career?
So I saw a company grow with the leadership of Bob Clark, you know, providing a vision and establishing that. And what I learned, I worked next to, I don't know if you ever met Russ Burns. Russ Burns was the CEO.
Yes.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Just passed earlier this year. And I had the opportunity to work with him a lot. And I learned a lot from him.
I bet you did. Yes.
A lot of direction, a lot of ability to make decisions, even when you don't know all the things that you might think you need for that decision. So a lot of assumption making, a lot of creating instructions and methodologies that would come to that outcome. And with him, I learned a lot about that. Like, you don't need to know everything. You just have to be able to figure out the next 5 steps, but you got to be very intentional about that. There were some quotes that he would say, like, don't hear what I'm not saying. And so I would always pay attention to then what was he trying to say when he said that?
Right.
But with Clayco, I had the opportunity to move in different roles from cost engineering, cost management, financial enterprise management. So I had the opportunity to work not just construction, but also different divisions of the company. So they back then, it was their design engineering, their glass company, Ventana. They had also their company for CSI, which was their concrete, and then CRG. So I had the opportunity not to see how just manage the GC world, but also different perspectives and how to fight, you know, those different angles and try to figure out how the vertical approach ultimately improves an organization from delivery, but also from a financial resiliency. So I had that chance, and, you know, working with people like Thomas Love in the technology area, and Nakona and the risk management, there's a lot of names here in St. Louis that would, you know, define a lot of the how-tos. And I think at Clayco, I was able to work side to them and learn from them.
So important. So important. Great, you know, wisdom for us, right? I mean, people, we always say those who know how show how, and really having that ability to have access to people like Russ Burns, I mean, what a gift.
Right. Yeah.
What a gift, Sam. Well, I want to talk about this because I know that you founded or co-founded Clayco Now.
Yeah.
Tell us about Clayco Now.
Yes. And I think they're doing a fantastic job now these days. But back then when I was at Clayco, I saw a need for creating a connection amongst all the females in the industry within Clayco and outside, because, you know, we touch subcontractors, we touch a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was at Clayco back in those days, I mean, now fantastic job that they've done in inclusion and diversity, but there was not females in the executive team. There was only Carol from the legal department. There was a few names that, you know, that I could think of, but there was like a very different approach to how to support women in the industry. And back then I remember going to Bob Clark and I said, hey, Bob, I think we need to do something like this. We work on a name, Clayco Now, Network of Women. Yeah, the rest was history. And we started to create, when I was there, my focus more so was in creating successful connections amongst the women of Clayco, but also providing some of the knowledge-based things that could help us for negotiation, for creating a lot more of a confidence amongst women.
Mm-hmm.
And they've done a fantastic job from what I see. We did bring, I was able to do the first Bring Your Daughter to Clayco. And I see the pictures, they keep doing that, and it's a fantastic,
aww,
and they have elevated it for sure. But it was great. For me, it was a good way to spend time with the community and learn from the National Women's of the National Association of Women in Constructions, have them like participate and yeah. just join. But I've also evolved a little bit from just working with women in the industry, in the sense of the more I have grown in this industry, this is kind of like a dichotomy in my thought process, but I have separated a little bit myself of only being in women only groups. Why? Because I think that while that is good for our ability to create those connections, I'm not sure those are the ways that are really creating results in the changes that we want to see in the construction industry. Mm-hmm. Yes, mm-hmm. with transparency, and I think is with giving opportunity to those who deserve it, and through fair, you know, assessment of skill sets and being part of those groups that can actually implement the change. So I, you know, it's like I've learned to kind of see both sides and say, how can I continue working with women to help them to get to those spots mm-hmm. outside being a woman in construction associations?
Yeah, I think there's a place for both. I think there's a place for both, Sam, because to your point earlier, the confidence, that's what we see sometimes with women mm-hmm. is there's a lack of confidence. So you can work on the skills, but sometimes, you know, having both
right.
female and male in there, you learn from each other too.
Right.
I mean, the men learn as much from the women, right? So, yeah.
And I have to say, some of my biggest allies in growing my career have been men. I mean, it's been so mm-hmm. the way that I think about that these days is, what boards am I part of? What one-on-ones I do with people, especially if someone reaches out and says, hey, do you mind meeting with so-and-so, my daughter, my friend, my coworker, who is in a completely different company. I'm like, that's right. where I spend most of my time nowadays. But it all started from that need of networking with other women.
Sure. Yeah. Well, that's why your calendar is so full, because you do those things, but they're important, right? And that's just who you are. If somebody says, hey, I have a daughter that's looking at construction, you're going to take the time, Sam, to meet with that person. And I love that about you. I know, like in 2019, you did receive the Inclusion Award from the St. Louis Council of Construction Consumers. Congratulations for that. All right. So let's pivot. Let's go to Brinkman now. So you are the CFO at Brinkman. What does a day in the life look like for you? I mean, you've already kind of told me that, you know, you will take these meetings to mentor young women and things like that. But what kinds of things would typically make up your day?
So Brinkman has changed even a lot since I joined. Back when I joined, we were 800 million. Now we have double that. Since then, we have opened two offices. So we now have offices in Denver. We've had offices in Denver and Kansas City and Richmond. And now we have an office in Phoenix. We opened an office in Phoenix, an office in Florida most recently. Am I forgetting one? No, well, St. Louis.
Yeah.
But so things have changed a lot.
Yes.
And I say that with a lot of pride, because I think a lot of the things that have remained are what makes Brinkman so special as a company. The people at Brinkman, we have fantastic people. But for me, I think, so I spend time, a lot of time with the leadership team, both the CEO and the president. And it's a lot of time also looking at different areas that I drive. Obviously, the financial, the accounting, the technology. I work also, I'm responsible for the technology area, so a lot of data. But day-to-day is to make sure that we have, you know, all the tools that we need to continue, like, moving the company in the right way. But first of all, I have a great team. I always tell everyone, so when I joined, I had the opportunity, and back then it was a pretty stressful, but I had to build a team from scratch.
Mm-hmm.
And creating a different infrastructure, because the company was growing too fast, in the sense of, even for finance and accounting, you have to have a true strategy on how you're going to deploy resources to decrease the impact to operations yes. in those areas. And so some people came actually from other companies that I work with, and that I'm always thankful for anyone who did that because they follow me without even me asking. So I always appreciate that. But here we have a fantastic team. And so that allows me to do a lot of like check-ins into, okay, what are the next things that we need to be working on for the next 2 years? So a lot of my approach when it comes as a CFO, yes, of course, I have to make sure that on a monthly basis and on a quarterly basis, we have accuracy. But to me, it's a lot of preparing for the next 24 months.
The future, months. Sure.
Mm-hmm. What, you know, and so in the last few years is working on developing a lot of infrastructure to systemize all that level of conversation across all our offices with the vice presidents. And spending a lot of time trying to define that. How does that look like? What is the financial impact? And what decisions we need to make sure that we're always above the curve. But on a daily basis, you know, I wake up, I make sure that my, the things with my son are figured out between my husband and I.
Yes.
And then I come to work and there's always something, people driven. I think I tell this to my husband and to my friends is that I never thought I was going to spend so much time figuring out people. That's ultimately right, because as leader, that's where you spend your time. How can you make everyone's not life easier, but their time at work more efficient? Mm-hmm. What are the barriers that they have that you need to be, moving from them? What are the things that you need to be doing for them? Because they're ultimately the ones doing the work. So my job is to make sure that the environment and the vision for our team is there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I totally agree with that. Your job is to make sure that your people are being able to be their best version of themselves while they're there, right? Because they're the ones that, are going to move the company forward. I mean, you can't do it on your own, right? It's working through other people. So I completely agree. Well, Brinkman has just a stellar reputation for those. We have people that listen all over the world, Sam. So if there's somebody in Europe that would love for you guys to open up an office in Europe, make sure you reach out to Sam. Just the quality. I mean, you can tell the difference between a Brinkman building and another building. There's just a higher level of
our passion to building, the people that we have within operations, our goal to satisfy the needs of our clients, to understand and to always have the second best right answer. That's something that Bob Brinkman would say often when he was walking around this building. But still, it's something that it's still on everyone's mentality, and make sure that we, cross any paradigm and that we question why and offer the best solution to our clients. And I think that I tell this to everyone, even in the finance and the accounting and the technology. If you ask anyone of my team, what do you do? Their response is we build buildings, because ultimately that's what we do. We have function within the company that ultimately presents that product.
Right. Something that what your function is, we build buildings. It reminds me literally of you probably know the story about JFK that had gone and, visited NASA and talked to a janitor and asked him, what do you do? And he said, we're putting a man on the moon.
Right.
So that end goal. I love that. I love that. Let me ask you this question. You have said, and this kind of gets more to the heart of leadership. You've said that solving a problem, you make sure that you're emotionally ready to execute the plan. That you're emotionally ready to execute the plan. Can you unpack that philosophy a little bit?
Yes. So actually, I tell people, we have here at Brinkman, we have something that it's called Basecamp. So that is something that it's fantastic for every new employee. We have one day that we meet within the first quarter, and we present everything about the company, the culture, what drives us. But we have always the chance to have a Q&A with the new employees, and there's always some kind of a question that comes out of that. And it's like, an advice. And I always tell, sir, I have a few and I rotate them, but this is one that always goes, is never quit on a bad day. Right? Don't quit on a bad day. And it's not necessarily don't quit your job. It's don't quit anything that you're working on the day that doesn't go the way that you think is supposed to be going. And believe me, that advice, I have to remind myself that every so often, because days are hard. There are some days that are harder than others.
Right.
Emotionally, at work, life, but also, you know, on your day-to-day, even conversations with your teammates, right? There's days that things don't go as you want them. And being emotionally ready, it means that you have spent the time, that you're calm, and that you feel confident that you can have that conversation out of a place of knowledge and not emotion. Now, emotion is always going to be there, and you have the ability to, and it's okay to show emotion. And it's great, actually, to show passion for what you are trying to, you know, like discuss or have the conversation. But making sure that it's not only emotion what is driving you to have that. And so I tell everyone, don't quit on a bad day. Don't stop a project on a bad day. Take a pause and do something that, you know, increases your endorphins. I tell Lynn and I were talking the other day, Lynn Shaw, and I was telling her, today I'm going to the gym earlier because I need more of that for my next few hours. And so it's getting in that right mental place, making sure that you have hobbies outside work, making sure that you have passions that allows you to put your brain somewhere else, that you have goals. I'm very goal driven. So
yes,
I always have to have something, right? Whether today, this morning, my husband and I were talking about something and I was like, yeah, when I climb Kilimanjaro, and he's like, yeah, when you climb Kilimanjaro. It's, you know, it's those things that, you know, get you to be emotionally ready for the conversations that are difficult. That you don't have everything, you know, all your thoughts are not in that place.
Right. That is so good. I love what you just said, because sometimes, you know, having that awareness of kind of where you are in that space, because sometimes like going to the gym or doing something different, Sam, can unlock things and possibilities, can unlock even answers to some of the challenges that you're trying to solve, right? And so, or taking a walk around the right building, or, yeah, you know, but don't quit
on a bad day. But also know, yes, that it's okay to cancel a meeting. Like, it's okay to, yes, say, you know what, it's not the right timing, it's not good for you or for me to meet right now.
Right,
it's, no, okay to do that, and it's, that's actually good. It's actually better for a business decision. I always tell everyone in my team, not every email requires a response. What I mean with that is that sometimes your first is like, let me respond that. And of course, every email requires a response, but not every email requires a response when the other person needs it. It there's a balance. You have to make sure, right, you're in the right place to even answer an email.
It's so good.
That you learn as you go.
Yeah, it's so good. So good. Well, I'm going to ask you, oh goodness gracious. There's so much to you, Sam. Seriously, you're a triathlete. You're an endurance cyclist. How has that discipline influenced how you approach business challenges?
So you got to think that I was raised in a place, I never had grass. I always joke with everyone because, and it, like everyone who knows me from Piedras Negras, like I never, like grass wasn't even like something that in my house we had. So that means that I never had access to sports. That means that we never had bikes or like a school that had, you know, programs for volleyball or whatever, like, mm-hmm, nothing. Like, so I was always like wannabe an athlete, but I was like, I don't have any. And then when I go to Monterey, which they have mountains and stuff and cycling and this, I didn't have the money to do any of that. And I had scholarships and I had a job. But I always would always, you know, be at the bus waiting for my bus or the metro or whatever to go to work. And I would see people with their bikes and stuff. And I was like, one day. And so eventually when I'm like, okay, this is my time, I get in triathlons. And this is a funny story, though, because I signed to one, to the Chicago Triathlon. And I, back then, my husband, also at Clayco, he had an office completely opposite of the building. And I go and I said, so I just joined the Chicago Triathlon. And he said, well, that's great, but you don't know how to swim. And I said, I know, but I'm going to figure it out. And so we went to the YMCA that night, and he knows how to swim and he tries to teach me and he's very supportive. But that day he says, Sam, maybe triathlons, it's not your thing. From all the things, probably this is not the one. But that, I was like, absolutely, I'm going to do triathlons.
I'm going to do it.
I got very obsessed with triathlons. I joined a team. I hired a coach. And I did the Chicago Triathlon back then. And since then, I've done a lot of triathlons. I've stayed to the Olympic distance. One day, I'm going to be doing the half Ironman and a full Ironman. But that helped me to realize that there's nothing I can't do if I don't, you know, all I need to do is train, make sure that I have the right mentors, the right people around me, and invest in me.
I bet you Nathan was pretty impressed with you that you were able to do that, right?
He was, because, mm-hmm. yeah, the first time I went swimming at the Y, like, the coordination wasn't there. So, when I did the Chicago Triathlon, and it's almost, you know, it's more than a mile swimming. It's probably like a mile and a half swimming. He was like, you did that. Yes. From a place of not knowing how to swim whatsoever. But then I got more so in the endurance. I did a century ride with my husband and a good, very good friend of mine. And what I learned there is to make sure you have the right people, because they kept, like, in those long distances is the people that surround you, the ones who are going to make sure that you accomplish some things that you can't do by yourself. Like, they would push me in some of the hills, the three of us biking, you know, they were stronger than me, so they were able to push. Some of them were mentally in a better spot in certain parts of the race, and they would say, you got this. And even when I was mad and some parts of the race, because I'm very math driven, and I was like, you know, if we continue going on this speed and doing this, we're going to, you know, so I'm always looking at the next 10 steps. And there's people who are like, but look at where we are right now. We're doing good. And so it's always good to have those teams. Endurance makes you that, you know, you can do that. I've done half marathons and stuff like that. So it's, you know, it's just one step at a time.
Between you and Nathan, I know Landon's going to just grow up being a really resilient little guy. And who knows? I know you guys well, and I know you guys love skiing.
Yes.
I know you. And Landon was pretty good at it, wasn't he?
Right. So now he goes to ski school every time we go to Hidden Valley. Every time we go to Park City or to Telluride or anywhere, like, he will.
And he's four and a half.
I was thinking, yeah, if we go to Deer Valley, he gets on it. And he has no fear.
Yeah, that's so awesome. Well, we need to wrap up here, although I could just talk to you for hours and hours and hours. I really want to encourage our listeners, though, go follow Sam on LinkedIn. I always love reading your articles. You put a lot of articles out there, lots of thought leadership, Sam. And so I'm hoping that our leaders will go and follow you. But I need to ask you, this is called Something Extra. You know, what do you believe is the something extra that every great leader needs?
So I think what I'm going to say is a little bit counterintuitive, but it's going to make sense. And I was thinking about this. It's disloyalty to what makes you successful. Now, I'm not talking about what, you know, it's part of your DNA and your culture and your beliefs, but it's that ability to look back and say, from everything I believe, from everything that I have learned, what are the things that I have to unlearn? What are the things that I have to challenge myself to think that maybe it's time to change? And what are the outcomes out of that? Is it the way that I lead? Is it going to be better? Is it the way that I go about a decision? For me, it was, and I wrote about this when my brother passed a year and a half ago. He had epilepsy. And when he died, you know, I started questioning a lot of the things that I thought that were, you know, part of life. And I start questioning, why do I think what I think? Is this something that was product of what? And doing that has obviously passed into my job, what I do every day, how I lead teams, how I hire, how I think about new processes and teams and say, do I know, am I trying to learn or am I trying to make sure that I, you know, question everything? What I mean with that is that sometimes, you know, we think that adding and learning is the way to go. And the more I go about life, it's like, maybe it's not about adding, and maybe it's about making sure that we question what we already know and we give space for new thoughts.
I love that. I've got a dear friend and mentor, Cheryl Bautelder, that was a CEO for Popeyes. And she encourages you, don't try and take in more information. Just sit with what you already know. And I do think in this world, I do think the information overload, right, Sam, can be, I don't know, can cause some anxiety sometimes.
Yeah, well, because there's so much, right? You're trying to learn about technology and people, and you're trying to learn about culture, and you're trying to learn about the economics, and you're trying to learn about and learn. And mm-hmm. sometimes you're trying to learn because you think of something else and you're like, well, that's the next thing. And mm-hmm. the more I've been finding time to kind of cut my thoughts and say, why am I thinking this? What makes me think this? It gives me the ability to challenge myself and challenge everything. And it is not even about what other people are saying, is what I'm saying and what I'm going to stand up in front of someone. I truly believe what I'm saying because it's the right thing.
Right.
So it's a different approach.
I love that.
I hope that makes sense.
That's different. That's different. I've not had anybody say that. So that's wonderful. I love it. Well, Sam, I knew this was going to be fun. I knew it was going to be fun. And I've just had a wonderful time with you. And I am so grateful for your leadership. I'm grateful that you landed in St. Louis because you make St. Louis better. And we didn't even talk about the Taste of Chefs for the March of Dimes. You raised twice the money that they were hoping to raise.
Three times
as money that they were hoping to raise. And so you're just, you're a bright light in our community. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Lisa. You were a huge support.
Thank you for listening to today's show. Something Extra with Lisa Nichols is a Technology Partners production. Copyright Technology Partners, Inc., 2019. For show notes or to reach Lisa, visit tpi.co/podcast. Don't forget to leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or wherever you listen.